From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Hope you had a fantastic weekend. We're back in action big time today. We're going to be joined this hour by Congressman Kevin Hearn of Oklahoma. Our Oklahoma listeners will love that. So will you, wherever you are. And we'll be able to take your calls. 1-866-408-7669. It's really a consequential show. And then tomorrow we're going to be at Liberty at Fort Liberty. Used to be Fort Bragg. That's what you know it as. Just converted to Fort Liberty. We'll talk about that. But it's going to be great to be with the 82nd Airborne, the 10th Mountain Division, and so many others, and find out what they're doing on a daily basis as we're just days away from Memorial Day. So we'll bring that to you. And we got some great guests, too, while covering all the other stories that matter. So there is news. It's stunning. So let's get to it.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The fact that Raisi died in a helicopter crash, in fog, no, at this stage, evidence or really any accusations that there was other foul play was a factor more than foul weather. If the Supreme Leader now tries to appoint his son after the previous president and the person who was going to get that job died in a helicopter crash, I think it would look suspicious.
Iran's president and foreign minister dead in a chopper crash in northern Iran. A successor will be voted on in 50 days. We'll look at the horrific rain and damages he's done in the Middle East and beyond.
Number two.
I never imagined in 2024 there'd be folks waiting to ban books in America. What in God's name is that about? Not only that, they're trying to erase black history, literally.
What is he even talking about? So irresponsible, but I should not be surprised. 2024, President Biden went on an emergency apology tour to black America in a desperate attempt to win back their votes. From the NAACP speech to Morehouse commencement, we gauged the chances of success as former President Trump talks guns with the NRA and debates the debate rules.
Number one.
But we're here about an hour early today. I was supposed to be making a speech for political purposes. I'm not allowed to have anything to do with politics because I'm sitting in a very freezing cold courtroom for the last 4 weeks. It's very unfair.
Yeah, it's an icebox, as he went on to say. We're talking to Donald Trump. The Trump trial, perhaps the final week. The defense says final day clashing with Cohen. Redirect to rehab Cohen. Will try for the prosecution. Then who knows? Perhaps closing arguments. And that's where we'll begin. So the President of the United States spoke a short time ago, at which time he quoted Greg Jarrett, Jonathan Turley, Andy McCarthy, all fantastic attorneys, all really good attorneys and offering analysis, as well as Alan Dershowitz, a liberal attorney, saying this is a sham of a trial. And we still don't know exactly what he's charged with. It's all going to come down, they say, to what the instructions are going to come from the judge about what the jury should be looking at. So Carolyn Leavitt was on with Maria yesterday, and here's what she said. Cut two.
It is possible that our defense team calls Mr. Costello to testify this week. That is up to the judge to approve that. However, what I will say is I'm not even allowed to comment on what Mr. Costello just said in that clip that you played because of the unconstitutional gag order that the judge has imposed on not only President Trump in this case, but also our entire campaign team.
True. And what it comes down to, why is Robert Costello important? Robert Costello, you may remind you, and if you missed Friday's show, Robert Costello was the attorney for a brief period of time for Michael Cohen. His goal was to get Michael Cohen out of prison and exonerated. So he said, give me everything you know about Trump. And he had nothing. So what else did Donald Trump do? Nothing. Well, what is he culpable of? Can you give the prosecution anything? Can you give these investigators anything? And he said, no, I can't. And then he quickly changed. He says, I will do anything to stay out of prison. At which time he said anything to stay out of prison, and he went to prison anyway. And that turned to bitterness and anger and the book Revenge and a podcast that showed he had a personal agenda. So here's Robert Costello also bringing up something else I didn't know. The whole NDA idea with Stormy Daniels, the NDA idea with Karen McDougal, that was all his idea. Cut four.
Well, the answer is obvious. That was his moment in time. If he had something truthful to say, I'm willing to cooperate. But he didn't take that. He kept on saying, I have nothing on Donald Trump. And then when we got into the discussion of the Stormy Daniels NDA, he said specifically, and I cross-examined him on this. This was my idea. It was his idea to take care of the NDA because he had been contacted by a lawyer for Stormy Daniels who said she was going to claim that Donald Trump had sex with her. Cohen said, I didn't believe the allegation, but nevertheless, it would be embarrassing to Melania. That's Michael Cohen's words.
So he sounds like a perfect witness for the defense. What experts told me is the downside would be that he was also representing Rudy Giuliani. And the New York Times, in trying to research for this segment and get ready for the one last week, I looked at Robert Costello when he's been in the news, and they say that he is suing Rudy Giuliani because Rudy Giuliani's firm is, because doesn't pay his bills, doesn't have any money left. And he's also somebody that was looked at, according to the New York Times, as a back channel to Trump. So if you bring him on there and the prosecution gets a hold of him, is there something that the defense doesn't know that would open another aspect to this case? They don't want to, and they feel, does the defense feel good enough about what they've done already, even to a New York jury, in taking apart Michael Cohen's story and finding him just flat out lying about a text message that was supposed to be at Stormy Daniels, end up being about harassment from a 14-year-old to him? Is that enough, along with going through Michael Cohen's contradictions and lies? Is that enough to get the case? So we'll find out. If a gray-haired guy is walking towards the courtroom today, it'll be Robert Costello, and he's going to sit down there. And the defense won't thoroughly rest, but the sense is there's not going to be many, many witnesses for the defense. They feel they have a pretty good case. But, well, I'm open to not knowing, because we don't know anything about their strategy. They don't make it public, and we don't know anything about the jury. It's no longer public except two or lawyers that we know of. So, and I wouldn't talk about it anyway because the judge doesn't want us to, so let's not screw with that. I found it really offensive, and if I was a member of the black community in America, I'd be really offended by the amount of pandering going on by this administration all of a sudden. And it goes to show me that even behind closed doors, things must be worse than even they say. So if you look at the polls right now, Donald Trump's got over 20% of the black vote. Now, that looks bad, except for the fact that, for the most part, since Richard Nixon, the person who's got the most black voters and since Nixon has been Richard Nixon with 13%. Donald Trump's at 20. They count on almost 95% of the black vote. 90% of the black vote is the goal. Now, all of a sudden, they're trailing. They lost 20 points to Donald Trump. You probably can't win the election. And because of that, Wednesday was a radio interview with black journalists. Thursday, meeting with Brown versus Board of Education families. Friday, remarks at the NAACP event at the African American History Museum in Washington, D.C. Saturday, an Atlanta event focused on engaging black voters, where he said that the new voting laws are Jim Crow 2.0, proven to be incorrect, inaccurate, as we know. Senator Mayorkas won again. Senator Warnock won again in Atlanta, three straight in Georgia, three straight times. And we know the turnout has never been better in Georgia in recent memory. So all that Jim Crow 2.0, unapologetic, and brings it up at a commencement address. Just so irresponsible. Such pandering. I hope people realize that. Front page of the New York Post is there's many graduates who turned their back on the stage, but they were warned if there's any demonstration, we're just shutting the whole thing down. Here's an idea of what I'm saying. Tell me if you think I'm wrong here. Cut eight.
You start a college just as George Floyd was murdered, and there was a reckoning on race. It's natural to wonder, democracy you hear about actually works for you. What is democracy? If black men are being killed in the street, what is democracy? Betrayal of broken promises still leave black communities behind. What is democracy? You have to be 10 times better than anyone else to get a fair shot. Most of all, what does it mean, as you've heard before, to be a black man who loves his country, even if it doesn't love him back in equal measure?
Are you crazy? Are you insane? Which is 1910 or 1960? You're trying to push back against George Wallace? Or about Senator Byrd, who you gave the eulogy at his funeral for when he was the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan? How is that the leader of a country that's trying to bring our country together? You want to just frame out how bad the country is for you? Totally inaccurately portraying what it is in our country. If you look at bright stars, what about the one you work for or work with and picked you as its running mate? Do we have a black president? When you look at Wes Moore, governor of Maryland, most Democrats say he is the future of the party. When you look at finalists to be the running mate for Donald Trump, you have this guy named Tim Scott, not born with a silver spoon in his mouth. Abject poverty is what I recall, and I witnessed first and foremost. If you look at, have a product that you need an endorsement from, and you want to sell that product, 90% of the time, more than likely, you're finding a black entertainer or a black athlete. If you thought America was racist, do you think we'd be giving the most valuable products to them to sell? I mean, what, at the very least, if there's progress to be made, go tell me what, how you do it. But you've been president for 3.5 years. You've been in government for 40 years. And you outline a country that reminds you as racist as South Africa. Thanks a lot, Mr. President. Appreciate your support. And by the way, he didn't stop there. He knows exactly who to blame for it. Here it is. Cut 6.
I never imagined in 2024 there'd be folks waiting to ban books in America. What in God's name is that about? Not only that, they're trying to erase black history, literally. They're wrong. They don't understand. Black history is American history. Not a joke.
You stupid, not a joke's retort. I cannot wait till I never hear that again. So, last time, I don't think I need to explain it to you, but I will. Governor DeSantis is not banning books. He has wants age-appropriate books in libraries. Doesn't want to hear about transgender books in grammar school libraries, even junior high school libraries. He doesn't want to hear about how bad and racist America is. It doesn't mean you don't hear about the American Revolution and the Civil War and about slavery. No one's erasing it. No one's twisting it. And people should not be having an anti-American agenda for grammar schoolers to brainwash them against their own country. That's a responsible governor getting age-appropriate books with content appropriate for the people of 7, 8, 9, 10-year-old boys and girls. That's not banning books. It's being smart about what kids are exposed to. Should we just get Pornhub and put that in grammar schools to make sure we're an open and free society? Or should there be a responsible way to approach this? So that irresponsible statements to extremely well-educated Morehouse grads is insane. But who wrote that speech? Mr. President, you're 82 years old. Stand up and go, I'm not going to write this. It's bad for the country. It's inaccurate. 1-866-408-7669. I want to get to the death of the Iranian president. What he accomplished in his short tenure. He is a personification of evil. The foreign minister, a really bad guy. He was in the crash. Evidently, 9 people lost their lives in that crash. I'm sure there are other VIPs we have not learned of yet. And it took Turkey to recover the copter and located it. You found out about the level of support that Iran has and who supported them. You see Russia all over it. And you see Pakistan all over it. And sadly, you see India all over it praising this president. How could a democracy praise this leader? When we come back, I'll take your calls. And Congressman Kevin Hearn, busy day. So glad you're here.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.
Out of the gates and ready to go.
Hey, it's Hutton Withrow. Hot Mike is here on the Outkick Network. We've got your afternoon covered with the latest sports discussion, and it's available wherever you find your audio.
Daily analysis and news. He is hot. I am Mike. Actually, my name is Chad. His name is Jonathan. But you get the picture. We're going to bring it every single day. Whatever you want to call us, we'll respond to. We just want you to respond to what we're dishing out every day.
And while you're here, we hope you're subscribed to the podcast. Like, subscribe, and share.
The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
So I think the death of the president has almost no impact in the short run because the president doesn't have a lot of authority over the things we would talk about on the show, national security and so forth. It's more of a domestic role. The real question is what implications does it have for the long-term legitimacy of the regime? And it gets at the splits within this society. My own guess, though, is this regime probably has, unfortunately, more staying power or continuity than any of us would like to see.
And that is Richard Haass, respected foreign policy mind, after the death of the Iranian supreme leader, Sizzo The word is the Iranian supreme leader says there'll be no disruption, but the Iranian president, Ibrahim Raisi, and the foreign minister confirmed dead beyond a helicopter crash in a remote region of northern Iran. They were saluting some dam and some innovation. And, of course, the chopper, 15 years old, could have been a malfunction. It looks so foggy, looked bad. Imagine something similar. They say what happened with Kobe Bryant. He's just insisting you get there against a better judgment. People are afraid to tell the president no. That's probably why he's dead. And he is. Evidently, they got his body coming back. But look at what a terrible person he was. A hardliner cracking down on innocent people in society. If you weren't wearing any of your Iranian headgear, they would have you jailed. And if you resisted, have you killed. They sent drones over to Russia, even though there would be great political risk and deny it. That changed the landscape in many ways against Ukraine. 300 missile strikes on Israel never before been done. No regrets, even though there would be repercussions. It would have been worse had we not held back the Israelis. He leaves all aspects of the nuclear deal. The brutal crackdown internally, elected with the lowest turnout in history. Everybody know it was a sham and a scam. So this guy was as bad as you can imagine. Under Raisi, Iran enriched uranium closer than ever to weapons grade. The president was shaken last year by mass civil unrest, so he started arresting and killing everybody in a brutal crackdown, not often seen even in that area. And you also find out now who their friends are and look out for them. Pakistan had anxiously been following developments regarding the reported crash. LS, they're not to be number one, along with the government and people of Pakistan, extend our deepest condolences and sympathies to the Iranian leader. The great Iranian nation will overcome. Indian Prime Minister Modi, deeply saddened and shocked by the tragic demise of Raisi, president of Iran. His contribution to strengthen India-Iran bilateral relations will always be remembered. Fantastic. Russia is so in bed with them. They sent two planes, helicopter, and 50 personnel to Iran to assist in finding him. It did not work. So how is he being received in the region? How is his death? How is his death going to affect U.S.-Iranian relations? Here's Dave Ignatius, Cut 35.
Even as Iran has been deepening its confrontation with Israel, firing 100 ballistic missiles and more than 200 drones in April, none of which were successful, it's been trying to open more of a dialogue with the United States. Last week, an Iranian foreign ministry official met with Brett McGurk, our top NSC Middle East person in Oman, to talk about issues of mutual concern. At the time of that missile strike, the Iranians made an effort to contact the U.S. through the Swiss embassy, exchange messages, understand exactly who would do what. So I think we're heading into a period where, as Khamenei himself said, there'll be no disruption in Iranian policy. But think about it. You've got uncertainty in Iran. You've got uncertainty in Israel. You now have almost an open contest for future leadership of Israel, and you've got an American presidential election. You couldn't have a more unstable mix of factors over the Middle East at this most dangerous time.
But what is there to talk about? You fortify the Houthi rebels, taking shots at us, the rest of the world, shutting down waterways, rocketing Israel. You see what Hezbollah has not stopped. The Israelis have been forced to evacuate miles of their northern border. Hamas hasn't knuckled under. The financing came through. The Wall Street Journal wrote that the Iranian National Revolutionary Guard was in meetings in Lebanon with Hamas leaders and Hezbollah leaders prior to October 7th. Of course, they can't be trusted. Why would they even want to talk to us? They're getting everything they want, including Iranian oil sales to China. Congressman Kevin Hearn is going to be talking to us about that and more. Brian Kilmeade Show. Glad you're here.
The talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. It's time to bring in Congressman Kevin Hearn of Oklahoma, 1st District Ways and Means Committee, Chairman of the Republican Study Committee and co-chair of Small Business Caucus. Congressman, welcome.
Brian, it's great to be with you this morning.
So first off, Congressman, when you think about the things that matter most to the American people, they say the deal breakers, number one, remains abortion at 15. At 14 is the economy. Where does your district stand?
Well, the number one issue here in Oklahoma is the border, and then certainly closely following that is the economy and what's happened with, you know, inflation over the last 3.5 years under Joe Biden with the 20% increase in price, and certainly wages not following that. So people are hurting across America. You know, following 4 great years under President Trump, they're ready to get back to President Trump's policies so we can get, you know, get our economy back where it needs to be.
Do you feel as though people are confident in Oklahoma when you talk about what's happening in Congress?
Well, certainly they're not. I mean, when you see all the disruptions, you know, I think everybody blames all of Congress. You know, I've talked to a lot of the new members that are coming in that are running, that are going to win their primaries. I believe they're going to be in Congress. They're hearing this across the country, you know, whether it be in Michigan or Alabama or North Carolina or even out in the West, is, you know, people are frustrated with what's going on. Why is the border not secure? Why is our economy still bad? Why is our energy policy so bad? And then certainly when you look at the chaos around the world, the foreign policy, so, you know, border, economy, energy and foreign policies, everything is a train wreck around the world and here in our country.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot of that now. We see the president of the United States is back in court today. We saw for 4 or 5 days the current president tell everyone how terrible Republicans are to the black community and how great he is and how racist Republicans are and how racist the country is, which is, for me, totally irresponsible. But when I talk about what's happening in Congress, I think Comer and Jamie Raskin were astounded when this blow up happened.
I'd like to know if any of the Democrats on this committee are employing Judge Mershon's daughter.
But that has to do with Merrick Garland. Do you know what we're here for?
I think your fake eyelashes are messing up.
No, ain't nothing.
That's
Chairman,
beneath even your degree.
That is absolutely unacceptable. How dare you attack the physical appearance of another person?
Are your feelings hurt?
Oh, girl, baby girl.
Oh, really?
Don't even play.
Baby girl,
So, and then it devolved further from that when Jasmine Crockett, the congresswoman from Texas, came back and said, what if a beach blonde, butch body woman, what if I was to call her that? Now she's printing out T-shirts for that. How embarrassing is that?
Yeah. Well, certainly the American people, you know, we have, like I mentioned earlier, you know, there's so many things going around the world that we need to be working on. And this committee devolved very quickly into name-calling and derogatory comments, and Americans are just shaking their head, not just, you know, in Oklahoma, but around the country going, can't we just get back to doing our job and legislating, again, securing our borders, the primary issue that we need to be working on. But, you know, every committee has its own set of dynamics, and clearly that committee had been put off, that hearing had been put off for about 8 hours. I actually watched that live, so I saw that firsthand. There's been no edits to what you just said, and that was very straightforward. And I talked to Marjorie Taylor Greene after that. You know, I think everybody's just really frustrated that, you know, we're not getting to the point and going back and getting President Trump in policy. And then in office, and when we see what the judge is doing, the judge is running this case, is giving to Democrats, and there seems to be nobody caring about this. And they've, you know, they sequestered the ability for President Trump to defend himself. You know, everybody's really frustrated right now with what's going on in this country.
But here's the thing, Congressman Hearn. A guy like you just does his job. You don't raise as much money as Marjorie Taylor Greene, who causes fireworks and just is out there for herself. And this woman, Congressman Jasmine Crockett, was summoned to Detroit to help out President Biden now. And she's selling T-shirts and she's raising money. It seems it pays to be irresponsible and juvenile.
Well, that's certainly where all the attention goes. You know, I spent 35 years in business before going to Congress 5 years ago, never been in politics. I really just wanted to go get the country back on track, you know, get a limited government, a Republican principle, you know, cut spending, get our economy back where it needed to go. And 2 years into President Trump's office, I ran and won as a fellow business person, and certainly felt like we were heading in the right direction until, you know, we had the election in 2020. But we've got a lot of work to do. The great thing is, Brian, is that we don't have to go wonder what the policies are that we need to get this country back in line, secure our borders, and to calm the world. I mean, President Trump did them. He wants to bring those policies back. I'm a huge supporter of his. You know, there's a lot of criticism of him and me and others that are American first conservatives. But what are we going to be if we're not America first? We're going to be American second, third, 10th, last. I mean, we've got to look at what we need to do to restore our confidence as a nation and to be the leader around the world. And then this president, Joe Biden, nobody fears him. Nobody has any respect for him. He can't figure out which way to turn on the stage, to direction to turn. He shake hands. He can't figure out where the stairs are. I mean, he goes to Morehouse College, as you said, and just contrast that from just a week ago with President Trump, where almost, 80 to 100,000 people show up and with enthusiasm and, just encouraging him. And then you go a week later and you got the president, this current sitting president of the United States, speaking to a college, telling black students that they have no chance. It's over. I mean, just despair and hope, which is, I thought a commencement speech was to be encouraging. It was to tell you what you needed to do and that this is a great America. And yet he told them that they didn't have any hope. And, when you see the polls with Hispanics and blacks more and more coming to President Trump, people want encouragement. They want hope. And Joe Biden doesn't encourage either one of those.
He doesn't. But, you are in the Ways and Means and you're all about spending and not spending and possibly cutting. And I think it's pretty disturbing that it's now clear that we spend more on the interest on our debt than we do on Medicare and defense. How long can we exist like this, especially with interest rates this high?
Well, we can't, and we've got to make some tough decisions. And I would tell you that Republicans have to make the tough decisions as well. We see it before us. The only thing that prevents us from being in a terrible situation is that we print money to secure this. I mean, if I met with a banker the other day at an event, and he was concerned about stuff, and I said, "What if I came to you as a banker and said I have a thriving business? It's a great business, but I need to borrow 100% of what it's going to take me to operate next year." I said, "Your response to me is, do you not have any sales? Oh, I have all kinds of revenue, but I'm spending twice as much as I take in." That's the situation that we have in America. The Republican Study Committee that I've chaired now for almost 2 years, we've historically been known for putting out balanced budgets. I put out a balanced budget, and probably one of the greatest statements that was ever made about the budget was from the White House. And Joe Biden personally called me out and said that this budget was so aggressive that it would destroy all the great policies that he has done since he's become president. And I thought, it's kind of a badge of honor. It wasn't intended to focus on him. It was intended to get the nation back solvent again.
Right. And there's certain things that's politically, third rail-ish to say, hey, Social Security's got to be adjusted, that Medicare's got to be addressed. No one wants to hear that it's running out of money, so no one wants to say anything of note. But the next president, the next Congress, has to explain to the American people what's at stake and get them on board and what it needs to pare all this down, don't you think?
I do, and I think we ought to come together, and I've said this for the last 3.5 years since when I chaired the Budget Committee and then as chairman of the Republican Study Committee, is that we need to come to, this shouldn't be a partisan issue about saving Social Security and Medicare. This should be what we do as Congress. There are plenty of other things to be political about. This shouldn't be one of them. We should be wanting to restore and have confidence that our seniors can have Medicare and Social Security for the rest of their lives. The budget that we put forward in the Republican Study Committee, it takes a look at people who are just starting into the workforce. When you started in the workforce, and I did a number of years ago, we never thought Social Security or Medicare would be there. But yet here we are in later life, people needed that. Our budget never touched anybody that was at or near retirement. And it was very fiscally responsible. We have less people working today to pay into these programs because the federal government is paying more people not to work, which is a problem in and of itself. We have to have more workers paying into these programs. And people that have been blessed in life to be successful and, things have gone their way, maybe they should take less. And make sure the people who have not been as fortunate can get enough to survive on. And, these kind of common sense, non-political positions should be taken by Congress. And that's what I've been advocating for. Mm-hmm. And yet the White House and many others have called me out for it. But I still think it's the responsible thing to do that, doesn't get a lot of press, mm-hmm. maybe like this committee just did.
So now they're going to be, the Senate's going to bring up the bipartisan immigration bill again. That Senator Langford of fellow Oklahoma, and to know him is to like him. You guys said this is the best deal we've had in quite some time, but most Republicans weren't for it. The former president wasn't for it. How do you feel about what's come out of the Senate side? And do you think it's going to end up in some way, shape or form on the House side?
Well, certainly, as political as Washington, D.C. is, back in March of last year under former Speaker McCarthy, we came together in one of the narrowest of margins in modern history of Congress and put out the second most important bill, the first being energy. The second most important bill was the border security bill. We put that forward. We sent it to the Senate, and the Senate never, Chuck Schumer never took it up for the entire year. And so I think that, you know, my fellow Senator James Lankford was sold a bill of goods by Chuck Schumer, allow him to put that on the floor. I think he went after him and set him up for failure. So, you know, I think right now what you're seeing across America is Democrats are as concerned about the border. You saw Tom Suozzi the other day put out a narrative in New York that Joe Biden needed to address the border. And he can do exactly what President Trump did. He can use executive order to secure our southern border and stop the millions of people that are crossing. And now you're seeing Democrats do it. And Schumer, once again, to try to figure out how to get a policy so he can help the president. And the unfortunate thing in all of this, Brian, is that they're doing it for political purposes instead of trying to secure a nation. And when you do something like that, that should be part of what we do as a legislative body, for political purposes, usually it doesn't turn out very well. And I'm fearful that we're going down the same path on the Senate side that we saw just, back 4 or 5 months ago.
Well, right now, migrants released on Saturday alone, 3,500, 2,000 crossed the border illegally. So now it looks like the biggest sieve is San Diego because Texas is beginning to crack down. But it's on the mind of everybody. And Joe Biden knows he broke it, but now he says that you guys don't want to fix it. So we'll see what happens when people get in there. Maybe they should demand a vote on H.R. 2, but evidently they had one. And it was purely on party line, which is not good for you guys. Congressman Kevin Hearn, thanks so much.
Thanks, Brian. Have a great day.
All right. He is head of the very powerful Republican Rules Committee, Study Committee. When you're listening to the Brian Kilmeade Show, I'll be back with your calls. And also, if you want to write me, go to BrianKilmeade.com and more. So glad you're here on this Monday.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
I think the guy who has more to prove is Biden. I think people, Trump is a known commodity. They know he's going to be an a-hole. He's going to be lurking and growling and not obeying the rules and everything else. But Biden, they want to see proof of life. After the last election, it was Trump is finished. And then a year later, it was, well, he's not going away. And then it was, uh-oh, he could win again. Mm. And now it seems like the consensus is almost Biden can't win. And he is losing in all the swing states, I think, except Wisconsin, and by bigger and bigger numbers. Is it too late to switch out? Because, like, in these states where Biden is losing, it's interesting. The Democratic Senate candidate is not losing. So it just says something, which is it's not the party necessarily, somewhat, but it's the guy.
That is Bill Maher saying it like it is. He also had no problem with the kicker giving that speech that was pro-family, even though, and pro-having kids and pro-having a wife, even though he has no kids and no wife and he's not religious. He said, what is wrong with the speech that talks about that? They knew what he was going to say, and why have a big deal with the commencement speech? The commencement speech, I'll tell you, if I'm ever asked, I think I've done two. If I'm ever asked, I will not even do it. I wouldn't even consider doing it. Who wants to be a part of this? These idiots, instead of graduating, enjoying the day and getting a different perspective, want to protest and give people a hard time and then make great controversy because of it. Some from you are writing me now. Linz writes this, the BS bipartisan immigration bill. That's right. You should constantly push H.R. 2. Dems are so afraid of H.R. 2. Schumer won't even bring it up to the floor for a vote. Secondly, folks are beginning to tighten their belts. So the economy will remain the top issue. That's a good point. I mean, that's what I think. You know, abortion can't be number one all the time, especially in states that already voted on it. What else could I tell you? Another email here about Gaza. I listened to you say that there are only 12,000 women and children were killed in Gaza. The rest were Hamas fighters. I checked it out. Then that is true. Reuters gave the real numbers the other day, but it came back with other numbers that the ones I'm talking about, the UN came out and corrected themselves. So bottom line is the President of the United States at that commencement address was applauding for people that were talking about Gaza rights or Palestinian rights. The president's applauding. I mean, because it's just a way to ingratiate yourself with the under 30s, because he's losing that vote, too. It's absolutely insane. So we'll see. The president's counting on the former president getting convicted, at which time they have a whole bunch of he's a convicted felon. Why would you put him back in the White House? Meanwhile, they'll go the segue to that to January 6th, and that's what they're running on, because they can't run on Joe Biden. And that's what's sad about Bill Maher. He also went on to say that I'm not going to get up every day like you had me the first time with a tingle up my spine thinking the former president's going to destroy the country if he wins. I'm not going to react like that. That's pretty much why a lot of people say I will not endorse President Biden, even if they will not vote for Donald Trump. Because they know that Biden has not been a good president, and they know that Trump was not nearly as bad as they thought, and some people think he was great. Here's Senator Tim Scott on President Biden's pandering to the black vote. Cut 11.
It's one of the reasons why you see so many black voters shifting to the GOP under Donald Trump. Why? Because Donald Trump delivered. We had the strongest, most powerful, and inclusive economy in the history of the country in my lifetime. Unemployment for black folks, under 6% for the first time ever. The wages growing at the bottom faster than the top. He also supported my opportunity zones, bringing nearly $70 billion committed to the poorest communities, often majority-minority. So you can compare abysmal failure to amazing success.
So there's some other numbers you might be interested in. President Biden's losing only 2% of his very liberal voters from 2020 to Trump. He is losing 16% of the supporters who describe themselves as moderate and conservative. Those people are going to Trump. How about this? Two-way presidential race among matchups for people under 30, for men and women under 30. They're tied at 49-49. Why is that significant? Because in 2020, Biden won with almost twice the amount, 61-36. The last three polls, Trump is up 53-45. Black support is waning. Up until this election, no Republican presidential candidate since Nixon in 1960 has won more than 13% of the vote. Right now, on a Fox News poll, Trump's at 23. He almost can't lose if it stays there.
News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for being here. I come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where downtown there's the court of the century, the trial of the century that could be in its final week. They say there could be one FEC defense witness. No word yet if Bob Costello will be another. We'll give you the latest. This hour, we're going to be joined by two important guests. And keep in mind, tomorrow is going to be a special show. We'll be coming to you live from Fort Liberty, used to be Fort Bragg in North Carolina. Lauren Wright's going to be with us at the bottom of the hour, and Michael Goodwin standing by now. So there's a lot going on here, too. Over the weekend, if you were in one of the boroughs, Brooklyn, they shut down the streets. 1,000 showed up, big pro-Palestinian population and rally. And, of course, the cops had to come and break it all up, right? Cops always have to be the bad guy, do the hard job. Let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
The fact that Raisi died in a helicopter crash, in fog, no, at this stage, evidence or really any accusations that there was other foul play was a factor more than foul weather. If the Supreme Leader now tries to appoint his son after the previous president and the person who was going to get that job died in a helicopter crash, I think it would look suspicious.
Yeah, it's just there's a lot of speculation what happened with the president of the United States. Bottom line is a rickety helicopter in a rugged region with bad weather. He's dead. So is the foreign minister. We'll tell you the ripple effects of that.
Number two.
I never imagined that in 2024 there'd be folks waiting to ban books in America. What in God's name is that about? Not only that, they're trying to erase black history. Literally.
Unbelievable. What a terrible speech. President Biden went on his emergency apology tour to Black America in a desperate attempt to win back their votes, from NAACP to Morehouse commencement address, we gauge his chances of success as former President Trump talks guns with the NRA and plans on having a rally in the Bronx.
Number one.
But we're here about an hour early today. I was supposed to be making a speech for political purposes. I'm not allowed to have anything to do with politics because I'm sitting in a very freezing cold courtroom for the last 4 weeks. It's very unfair.
It's an icebox. Trump trial, perhaps the final week. The defense says the final day, clashing with Cohen, redirect to rehab Cohen. We'll see how that goes. Who knows? We have closing arguments as early as today. Maybe a verdict. Who knows? But I know one thing. The president of the United States wants this thing over with. The question is, how much damage will be done if there's a conviction? And judging by what this case is now, Michael, as I welcome you in from the New York Post, what you thought about going in and the impact of a conviction and what you think about now?
Good morning, Brian. Well, look, leave aside the second conviction because I can't read the jurors' minds. But I do think that what I am surprised about is how little proof of an actual crime the prosecution presented. You know, I had my doubts about this case in the beginning, that it seemed to be a stretch to call this these 34 felonies. But the fact that they would become felonies, 34 bookkeeping entries, et cetera, that they are misdemeanors, but that they would become felonies because they were designed to cover up another crime. That other crime has never been presented. So that I find that shocking. I mean, I don't know why the trial was even allowed to happen. How can you not detail to the defense what it is they have to defend against, which brings you very quickly to this judge and the fact that he is, I believe, tainted by his association with his daughter's fundraising for Adam Schiff and other Democrats, with his own contributions to Joe Biden and a group called Stop Republicans. Now, it turns out he secretly knew, the judge, that he had been, shall we say, slapped on the wrist by an ethics panel. It just came out over the weekend. What they did was they turned down the request that he be forced to recuse himself, but they did say what he did was wrong in making those contributions because, as a judge, he's not supposed to make any political contributions or otherwise align himself with a group whose interests may come before his court. So he clearly is tainted. And it is hard to separate that taint from his decision to let this case go forward when the prosecution never yet revealed a second crime that is essential to making the misdemeanor a felony. I mean, it boggles the mind. Now, as for the jury, if you have 12 people on there who only read the New York Times and hate Donald Trump, they're going to convict him of anything. They would have convicted him on the first day before testimony. That's the problem with this case.
Here's what Eli Honig said, one of the lead analysts on CNN, Cut 3.
I don't think I've ever seen a star cooperating witness get his knees chopped out quite as clearly and dramatically as what just happened with Michael Cohen. I've certainly seen very effective cross-examinations of cooperating witnesses. I've seen aspects of their story cut into and called into question, but this goes to the heart of the allegation here, that phone call on October 24th, and it looks to the jury and to Anderson Cooper and Kara Scannell and Judge George Grasso, who are all in the courthouse, that was a devastating moment.
Yeah, because that was supposed to be the moment he contacted Trump about Daniels, and it wasn't. Now, just to give you an update on the trial, Cohen is now admits talking with Trump about the Daniels deal because it was important to him. So it's still on the cross-examination, and they'll see if they can rehab him after that. Bob Costello said something interesting. First off, do you believe they should call Bob Costello, the former attorney, to Michael Cohen?
Look, if he has something like what he told Congress last week, by all means. I mean, if I were the defense, I would put on a defense I don't think Donald Trump should testify. I think that given what we've seen about Michael Cohen and how he has not surprisingly been shredded, his character, I don't think Trump should subject himself to cross-examination by the prosecutors. I think it would just give more fuel for any juror who hates him. I don't think he can win a personality contest in that courtroom, and he shouldn't even try.
Right, and then we'll see what happens afterwards. I want you to hear a little of I apologize to Black America for ignoring you tour that that Joe Biden's on. Here's what he says, and I just think it's so irresponsible. Cut eight.
You start a college just as George Floyd was murdered, and there was a reckoning on race. It's natural to wonder, democracy you hear about actually works for you. What is democracy? If black men are being killed in the street, what is democracy? The trail of broken promises still leave black communities behind. What is democracy? You have to be 10 times better than anyone else to get a fair shot. Most of all, what does it mean, as you've heard before, to be a black man who loves his country, even if it doesn't love him back in equal measure?
Are you kidding? I mean, what the hell is that?
Well, that is the pander. That's the pander in play, and it is designed to make black men, in this case only, feel angry about their country and to come out and vote for Joe Biden over Donald Trump. Now, as you say, Brian, the way you asked the question, I mean, it's as though Joe Biden is new to government. It's as though we didn't have a black president. So even if you just took the straight lines of what he said, it would be that America has always been racist. There's no difference whether Democrat, Republican, president, Congress. I mean, it made no sense. But that don't forget, this is the same guy who, in the campaign against Mitt Romney, said to a black audience, Republicans want to put you all back in chains. I mean, this is the level that Joe Biden will sink to get a vote. I mean, and if it has to be fear-mongering, so it goes. I mean, that is the political creature at heart, and it's disgusting, it's disgraceful, it's dishonest, and it's Joe Biden.
Yeah, and meanwhile, he did work for a guy named Barack Obama, who was the first black president. He could have a very positive speech to say. He could talk about working with Wes Moore. He could have a lot of positive things to say. He could say, hey, Tim Scott is a leading candidate to be number two for the Republican ticket. That's a lot to say if you're trying to inspire a group and be president instead of desperate to get them back in your corner. After he appeared, by the way, in that same speech, he appeared to confuse the pandemic with the financial crisis, claiming he was VP at the time of the pandemic. So he says, I love Detroit for three reasons. Number one, but does not appear to state what the other two reasons are.
You know, all the more reason, Brian, why the White House should be forced by the courts to reveal the recording of his interview with Robert Herr to see why Herr concluded that he is a forgetful old man who is just lost it. I mean, that recording would be devastating. So, as you reported, the White House has said it's immune, it's confidential, it has an exemption from this release of, we got the transcript, but the recording, I think, would really give flavor to why Robert Herr thought Joe Biden could not be tried. I mean, this is the President of the United States who the prosecutor said is basically too addled to be put on trial. He would be sympathetic. Now, imagine that. This is the guy who wants four more years.
Right. And Michael, I just wanted to get you on to talk about what you think the Iranian president dying in a helicopter crash with that foreign minister who seems as evil as the day is long. And, you know, Iran is at the root of all the problems right now, almost all the problems in the Middle East. Your thoughts about him being dead and what it could mean.
Well, look, I think the first thing to understand, Brian, is that the Iranian people have suffered greatly under Raisi and the supreme leader. And the Iranian people turned out to celebrate last night. And, of course, the government sent the thugs out to punish them. I mean, what the brutality against their own people tells you everything you need to know about the Iranian government. Yes, they hate America. Yes, they hate Israel. They want to kill. They arm fanatics and terrorists. But it's what they do to their own people that I think is equally revealing about who they are. So to Raisi and his fellow travelers, good riddance.
I know that sometimes diplomacy can be, you have to talk to your enemies, but I'm a little offended that they're having secret meetings in Oman again with some other leaders to try to get us together with Iran again. So we're kissing up to Hamas by not letting them go into Rafah. We're limiting the arms sales to Israel for finishing off Rafah. We're building a $350 million platform to feed the Palestinians. And now we're meeting with the person who the country's at the root of all of this, Iran, secretly again.
Yes, and much of what you detailed there is aimed simply at giving Joe Biden the votes of Muslim Americans in the upper Midwest. That's all it's for. He doesn't give a rat's tail about what's going on. He just wants to win the election. We see that with the speech at Morehouse. We see it with his foreign policy. I mean, he's an absolute disaster.
So there's two things that I think are going to work for the president's favor and two major things. With the trial, I think the gag order works for him. It just keeps him out of trouble. It keeps him from talking about the case and people talking about him being the sideshow of maybe he's affecting the jury. Well, now it's stopped. And I think when it comes to the debates, they say killing the mic in between comments, as much as I like the interaction, I think it's going to help Donald Trump. Because Donald Trump can finish a thought. But you know who can't uninterrupted? Joe Biden. And you know what? Marjorie Taylor Greene, by screaming out, saved him. He was getting lost in his own speech. And by trying to answer a question, Trump will be forced to jot a few things down that are inaccurate and flat out false. And he knows it. But sometimes in the heat of a debate, you just want to go back at the guy, calls you a liar, calls you a danger, threat to democracy. You want to go back. But if you listen, collect your thoughts in an old fashioned style way and then fire back, I think it's going to make for an advantage Trump. Here's Sarah Isker, a former DOJ spokesperson for Trump, turned against him on ABC, Cut 14.
I think, believe it or not, this actually probably helps Donald Trump. He may not like his mic cut off, but to force him into a more disciplined debate environment will probably help him because it will empower the moderators. It'll make it a watchable debate. Part of what happened in 2020 is that the debates were unwatchable. The candidates kept talking over each other. I have no idea what they were trying to talk about. And so the debate didn't matter at all. There is actually a chance if the mics get cut off and we actually hear what they say, the moderators in charge, that this debate could matter.
The problem is the moderators suck.
Jake
Tapper, Dana Bash.
I think you made a very good point, Brian, about, and so did she, about the mic cutoff.
Yeah.
If you have fair moderators. And that is the question. I mean, I don't know why. I think Trump is overly confident that he will be treated fairly or he'll get a chance to correct the record with the CNN. I mean, do we know yet who's going to be the ABC moderator for the second debate?
Yeah, Bill Muir.
Okay, not Stephanopoulos.
No.
He gave a speech basically echoing Joe Biden about the dangers of Donald Trump. I mean, these news organizations are infected with Trump derangement syndrome. And these particular moderators in the first ones, I mean, you would be hard-pressed to find a single critical thing they said about Biden or a single good thing they've detected in Donald Trump. So he has not just Joe Biden to worry about. The moderators are on the other team.
And by the way, this is just an update. I got to wrap up here, but it looks like more movement on Michael Cohen. Not good for him. I'll tell you on the other side. Don't move.
Challenging conventional thought and wisdom. You're with Brian Kilmeade. Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So Michael Cohen's back on the stand, at which time it's been reported. Keep in mind, we don't have the transcript yet. He says he stole from Donald Trump's organization. He also said that he had a lot of trust in the organization, and he did say that he stole from the organization. So again, working at what he did behind the scenes, when you have a lot of latitude, that's good, but it also makes you accountable to yourself. And ultimately, you're trying to blame the chief executive for stuff that you did on your own. What the defense is saying is this stuff he did on his own. All the details of which he went on his own because he had a goal, and that was to look out for the president. And you want to go over and quibble about whether it's personal or professional? I don't know. You're going to tell me that he was happy that Melania was going to know about it when he's already on the record, other people from Hope Hicks on down saying that absolutely was a chief worry about his. He had great respect for her. Same with Rana. Same with Madeline, who also worked close with him. So, and now we find out you stole from the organization as well as lying about text messages. Not good, Michael Cohen.
From his mouth to your ears, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, we're back. Lauren Wright's our guest, PhD and associate research scholar and lecturer at Princeton. Lauren, welcome back to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Brian. I'm so happy to be with you.
Yeah, I mean, we have battleground states right now, and about the last three polls, six or seven of those states are going to Donald Trump. Do you think the fact that you had Joe Biden out to four or five different African-American events, from African American Museum to Morehouse commencement, that shows that the numbers are even worse than we're seeing is internal?
I mean, they could be. There's some suggestion of that in 2022. Republicans actually did pretty well among black voters. And then every poll, as you probably know, shows that Trump has made more gains than any Republican basically since the 1960s. And so I don't think that means that Trump's going to win black voters necessarily. But if Democrats are pushing this aside and they're not worried about it and they're not even interested in the trend, that spells really big trouble for them. And so that's probably part of the public events that you're seeing.
But it's a lot of blitzing. It blitz like I've never even seen before. I could see if this is last week. But I mean, when you see four or five events in a row, and especially going to a place like Atlanta and then telling everyone it is Jim Crow 2.0 with the election law, I'm thinking to myself, do you know he's been fact checked on this?
Oh, I mean, yes. So there's part of this message that's a little bit insulting to black voters because, first of all voters are angry for the exact same reasons, which is the economy, especially inflation. Things are just more expensive and people feel less safe than they did 4 years ago. And that's why Trump is ahead in a lot of these swing states. So there's no particular message that Biden can send to the African American community to ameliorate those things because they're upset that they don't feel they have a situation of prosperity. They feel less safe. And so it's just reflective of the general polls as much as anything. And I think that's a really important point to make.
So when you talk about deal breakers, abortion still number one, 15%. Economy's number two at 14. Border security's just mentioned 14. Candidate qualities are 7. Party affiliation is 6, election integrity is 5, and foreign policy is 4. Having said that, does that have everything to do why Senator Schumer's reintroducing the so-called bipartisan immigration legislation from a few months ago?
Well, I actually don't think abortion's a deal breaker, and I'll tell you why. It's an issue that absolutely benefits Democrats, and they have the leg up on that issue, no question. It's a problem for Republicans. But it's also an overwhelmingly positive advantage for Democrats when we ask about it. But compared to other issues like immigration, like crime, like the economy, it's not high on voters' list of priorities. So I also think it would be a mistake for Democrats to assume abortion is the only issue women voters care about and the only issue that moderates care about. It's really not.
It's just what the poll said. It kind of caught me by surprise, too. When they said what a deal breaker is, that was a little different than concerns. So the president of the United States, the former president of the United States, is in court. We know that. We know that also tomorrow he's going to be having a rally. He's going to be having a rally in the Bronx, a place where he got maybe 4 or 5% of the vote. What's the wisdom of that? I love it. And I think you know, if Joe Biden should go to Oklahoma and Nebraska and to Texas and just do your best to try to win over support. Don't just go to people that like you and try to maximize the area. But what's significant about that?
Well, I think Republicans should try to win everybody. And it's similar to what you're saying, Brian, is why not try to win overs? Why ignore entire parts of the country that have just consistently voted one way or another? It's also just logistically a consideration that Trump's in court. He's in New York. He's in New Jersey. He, of course, has homes in both of these places. Why not try to campaign and talk to as many people as possible in these huge population centers? I probably disagree with you a little bit about whether we know if the court case will not hurt or will benefit Trump. I mean, I think the charges are serious, but it's just one of those issues that people don't really care about. They care more about themselves and their families and their financial and security situations.
I do. I agree with you, especially when you looked at the Access Hollywood tape when it came out. Looks devastating. Within a couple of weeks, everything had changed. The news cycle had changed. The focus had been elsewhere. You know, and next thing you know, you had the emails and nobody was even remembering the Access Hollywood tape, let alone a case that's going to be decided this week or next. By the time the conventions roll around and then the fall sprint when everyone's really paying attention with the second debate, you could see it being plowed over. However, a felony is a felony. And I'm just wondering if this is a felony, no matter how confusing this trial is. And I think ridiculous. Not everybody does, but I do.
Very confusing.
Right. Yeah. Confusing. It does it matter that the other side will be running to Trump, will be running, he's a felon. Why would you put a felon in the White House? He's been convicted and this and that. Would those ads online and elsewhere, billboards, would that make a difference with the undecided's independence?
It might. And what we don't know is as much about how this might affect an election because we've never seen a president in this situation before. So the way I kind of look at it is, it's like you said, you know, a crime is a crime, however confusing, and most people don't pay attention to or care about campaign finance laws, nor should they. But we also have 33 million small business owners in this country who cross every T and dot every I, and they live in fear, really, of regulators and the IRS, and they couldn't imagine, you know, making this kind of mistake, even if it's paperwork, even if it's a misdemeanor. And so I do think that's alienating to a lot of people. I just think it does go back to this point of how threatened are people by Trump paying hush money to a porn star? Probably not nearly as much would be my guess as seeing chaos on the borders, chaos on college campuses, and feeling financially very insecure and worried.
But the point is, too, as you know, paying off a porn star is not illegal. An NDA is not illegal. The question is, what column did you put it in? And and election interference. And still, that would be a fine. But now they bootstrap it to it being a federal crime, which has never been done before. But it allows the statute of limitations to go all the way back to 2016, which doesn't happen for P. Diddy, but it happens to the former president, which is a little bizarre.
Well, and that's the part I think that's very difficult for people to understand. But legal analysts from all over the political spectrum have essentially said this might be the only case we'll get to see decided, and it's the least serious comparatively to the other things Trump is facing.
By the way, we're talking to Lauren Wright, a lecturer over at Princeton, giving us inside this election. So we found out it was back-channeled before, but they were working on it before the announcement. But there is going to be a debate, and it's going to be coming up at the end of June, and it's going to be coming up a few months later, at which time there's going to be rules where they mute the other person's mic when the other one's talking. I don't know how they're going to do it when the exchanges happens. And they're not going to have a live audience. That's the other thing to keep in mind. So without a live audience and those things, Donald Trump says, I'll do anything to debate, I'll do it. How do you think that plays into what we're going to see?
Well, Trump's entertainment skill set is much better suited to a presidential debate than Biden. We just know that because it's show business, essentially what it is. We can debate about whether our presidential selection process should look like that or not. That's not the question. Yep. But as long as it is, Trump benefits from those events. However, I do think there's this tendency to set such a low bar for Biden, and this happened during the State of the Union, that if he's able to get through it and say a few things and defend himself a couple times, then Democrats can also paint that as a huge victory. And so I think it's important not to exaggerate one direction or another. I'm very happy it's happening. I will be watching for sure.
So I want you to hear this exchange. People saw the State of the Union, and they saw that there's a very aggressive Joe Biden, a guy that was a lot different than he was just a week or two before when he was trying to dispute the Robert Hur story. It leads people to wonder, is he on something? That's what Congressman Greg Murphy brought up. Listen to this. Cut 16.
I'll just be very plain and simple. I was in the State of the Union address, and Joe Biden must have been jacked up on something that day. I absolutely believe that from a medical viewpoint, and actually have a little bit of good knowledge that that happened. He can't stand it. He can't stand under the lights for that long, and I don't think he can keep a concept in his brain that long.
Congressman, what do you mean when you say he was jacked up at the State of the Union?
I believe they gave him something to help him sustain the lights and sustain the vigor that he had. That was not Joe Biden. I was in there. He screamed for 2 hours.
What are your thoughts on that? Byron Donald said something similar.
I have no thoughts on that. Oh my gosh, I'll leave it to the medical community, Brian. I don't know.
You did notice a different demeanor.
Yes, but, you know, adrenaline can make someone different that way. A lot of caffeine can make someone different that way. I have no idea. I mean, I honestly think the bar was so low that just the fact that Biden got through it, yelling or not, or no matter how coherent, was a win for the White House.
Tell me in Democratic circles, from what you know and have heard analysts say, what Bill Maher said over the weekend. Cut 20.
I think the guy who has more to prove is Biden. I think Trump is a known commodity. They know he's going to be an a-hole. He's going to be lurking and growling and not obeying the rules and everything else. But Biden, they want to see proof of life. After the last election, it was Trump is finished. And then a year later, it was, well, he's not going away. And then it was, uh-oh, he could win again. And now it seems like the consensus is almost Biden can't win. And he is losing in all the swing states, I think, except Wisconsin, and by bigger and bigger numbers. Is it too late to switch out? Because, like, in these states where Biden is losing, it's interesting. The Democratic Senate candidate is not losing. So it just says something, which is it's not the party necessarily, somewhat, but it's the guy.
Are they still talking about switching out? Do you hear that?
Oh, well, you know, people say crazy things, you know, and it's not just my friends and colleagues, but I hear people say all the time, what about Gavin Newsom? What about Michelle Obama? I mean, first of all, the problem with any other candidate is Biden beat most of the viable candidates the first time around. So he really is the best bet Democrats have with all of his flaws. You know, Kamala Harris is much less popular, for instance. She might not be electable in a national election. We've never really seen vice presidential popularity ratings that are consistently lower than the president they serve. But I think it's very low chances that Biden's not the nominee.
I hear you. So we'll see what's going to happen going into Memorial Day.
We're
going to have a verdict or we're going to have a continuation because it looks like the fence is only going to put up one person, maybe two, and then there'll be closing statements, which some say is going to be a same day. They could be wrapping the same day. It seems the judge is in a rush to get this done by Memorial Day. So, Lauren, then you'll have something else unprecedented to analyze.
Sounds good. Thank you, Brian.
She's a PhD, associate research scholar, and lecturer at Princeton. Lauren Wright, thank you. All right. When we come back, we're going to give the latest on the trial. We're starting in some reports for our people there in the overflow room and the ones that are actually in court. It's not been a good morning for Michael Cohen, but this is all about his resume and what he did. There doesn't seem to be any discovery. It's just more of an angry Michael Cohen left behind while everybody else went to Washington. And not only that, that Donald Trump got his own attorney that really got his own attorney in Washington that really angered Michael Cohen. Brian Kilmeade Show.
The fastest growing talk show in America. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
A talk show that's real. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Hey, we're back and trying to get you an update on the trial that's going on. They started early this morning, so we're getting much more information early on. We don't have the president's remarks from today. They happened during Fox and Friends. And now, as we continue here in New York City, this is about, I don't know, 27 blocks from us now. So we got a report from our reporters, court experts inside. By the way, Trey Gowdy is inside today, too. But Allison, what are we getting now?
Basically, it's just like a devastating stretch for Michael Cohen right now that Cohen admitted to stealing from the Trump org.
This is part of the cross, right?
Yes. While he was leading us to believe that just last week he was clean on his end of the repayment plan, and now we were learning all of the various legal work Cohen continued to do for Trump and Melania while he was operating as their personal attorney and getting paid each month, i.e. legal expenses. For the big picture, this is Carrie Kupak, who also sent this. She's like, now we have a lawyer, Cohen, who stole from his client, a lawyer who secretly recorded his client, a lawyer who is obsessed with his client and still is, and a lawyer who lied about his client both under oath and not under oath. So just not a great picture for Cohen.
So Michael Cohen coolly admitted stealing $30,000 from the Trump Organization after overstating how much he is needed to be repaid for fronting funds to a poll rigging tech company called Red Finch. Cohen testified that he handed the CEO of the company $20,000 in cash in a brown paper bag in exchange for services that included rigging the 2016 election poll to Donald Trump's favor. But when Trump's and financial officer Alan Weisselberg asked him during a 2017 meeting whether he needed to be reimbursed $50,000 for this, Cohen went along with it, pocketing the difference. He said, "You did steal from the Trump Organization based on the expected reimbursement from Red Finch." Todd Blanche says, "Yes, sir." Trump broke away from his eyes closed position during his exchange and popped a mint before appearing to pay close attention to Cohen's testimony. Quote, "Have you paid the Trump Organization for that money you stole?" Blanche asked. "No, sir," Cohen said. Come on. So you got to admit it, right? When you're on the stand, Allison, you have to admit it or else you could be perjuring yourself because they probably have facts on it. But I mean, I just wonder in the prosecution, with all the coaching from Goldman and everything else, didn't they say, tell me everything that you've done that could possibly come up? And is it still worth the risk to bring him up? So he stole from the organization. He did things on his own. He monetized the relationship. He monetized the breakup. He monetized the jail. He goes on. He goes and gets a podcast. He monetized that, all in obsession with Donald Trump. So acting on his own without Trump knowing, there's more proof of it.
And that he will consistently lie just to better himself, regardless of the circumstances.
Loves being the victim. I mean, obviously, we should get Dr. Drew in here. Loves being the victim. Right. I'm suicidal. I can't believe I'm not going to Washington. What a failure I am. I'm
not even
throw myself.
He just wants to be in the center of, you know, he wants to be in the action. He wants to feel important. He wants to feel the power. But I think that would be very fun to get Dr. Drew to analyze him.
That might be a good idea. He probably did. I remember he had a lot to say. Dr. Drew had a lot to say about somebody else we thought was going to be a big deal, and that was Avenatti. He said, "I have so much to say about Avenatti. He profiles so many psychosis that he deals with regularly." You know, by the way, we should announce tomorrow we're going to be in North Carolina at Camp Liberty. You know it better as Fort Liberty. You know it better as Fort Bragg. It just changed names because, believe it or not, I found this. General Bragg was not even a known Confederate general. You know they named it after him? After the way he fought in the infantry in the Spanish War. So it was this no reason to have changed the name of this base. I know the soldiers aren't going to get and the generals don't want to hear about that, but we're going to see what they go through on a daily basis, maybe demo some stuff. They already showed me some video, tanks, gun ranges, jumping off. It's going
to
be great.
So demoing it, does that mean you'll be jumping off things
if
and flying through the air?
If I need to save somebody in a training exercise, absolutely.
Don't get hurt.
Quick announcement, Allison, as you know. June 29th, don't make plans. We'll be in Indianapolis, Indiana at the Shelton Auditorium. Go to BrianKilmeade.com so I can see you in person, live on stage, and then on the 27th of July in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania at the Sherman Theater. History, liberty, and laughs.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division.
It's Brian Kilmeade.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. Just when you think you could predict what we're going to be talking about and have a rough idea leading to Memorial Day, in comes that that helicopter accident that killed a foreign minister who I think is as evil as it gets in Iran and their evil president. He is now dead, and no idea what happened except for the conditions were absolutely horrendous. The fog was extremely thick. It took a long time to recover. I know the Russians sent helicopters of their own, planes, 50 search and rescue people. But it evidently was found by with the aid of Turkey in the northern part of Iran. But in New Year's, as soon as you heard that a chopper went down, it's very hard to survive that. So we talked about that. Today's Trump trial, we saw the president come out earlier today and speak. And then we know the Trump trial could wrap up as early as this week. Let's keep our fingers crossed that it is, because we need an end to this, get the president, the former president, back out there. And we're also going to talk about 2024. President Biden must be panicked. He's done four events around African-Americans over the last few days while just trashing this country in the meantime, especially at Morehouse College. His speech was absolutely horrific, in my view. He's the president of the United States. Stop running down the country and saying that every black man's going to get shot and you have to work 10 times as hard to make it in America. Didn't you work for a black president when you were vice president? Isn't the most promising politician in the country the governor of Maryland, many people think, at least on the Democratic side? And guess who's the finalist to be the running mate of Donald Trump? A guy named Tim Scott. I believe, according to reports, he's black. Can you talk about any type of sponsorship when it comes to athletes and entertainers? African-Americans get most of them because they sell products, because America does not have that bias that you claim it has. Meanwhile, cops also vilified in the president's speech. I talked to Bill Alexander, the CEO of the National Police Memorial Fund. You only got a chance to see about 45 seconds of it last week. I want you to hear most of the interview. He's just such an impressive guy, a former cop now running that organization. And last week was Police Week. Here it is.
Bill Alexander, CEO of this organization, what's your responsibility here today?
My responsibility here today is to try to help tell the stories of the men and women whose names we will read tonight at our very sacred ceremony, to try to help honor, remember, remind the nation the terrible sacrifice that so many men and women each year make on our behalf, protecting and preserving our democracy and keeping our community safe.
282 names go on that wall. What went into their selection?
282 men and women we identified who died in the line of duty in calendar years 2023 and years prior. These men and women were shot and killed. They were killed in traffic accidents responding to calls for service. They were killed in medical events sustained as a result of taking a law enforcement action. Some of them developed cancers unique to the recovery efforts following the terror attacks in 9/11. Those and more we represent and honor here tonight.
So there's going to be over 30,000 people here today. What does that tell you?
It tells me that, in part, every single one of these deaths has such a deep and lasting impact on the law enforcement community. But it also tells me, as a citizen of this country, which I think we're so lucky to call home, that the citizens of this country also feel that impact, that they're willing and able to come out and help support not just the surviving family members, not just the men and women who are still out there doing the job, but to support all of us in law enforcement, everyone who ever has or ever will wear the badge.
Why more than ever? Do you guys feel a bond, almost as like you against them?
You know, the law enforcement community is so close and tight-knit. There's only about 800,000 men and women who are actively sworn at any given time, trying to patrol a population of 350 million. And every single one of the deaths has such a deep impact. Every single police officer that I know someone personally whose name is on our very sacred wall. Every one of those men and women whose names are on our walls has a story, has a father, has a child, has a sibling, has a spouse, many of whom are with us here tonight to help celebrate and honor their loved ones.
The thing that strikes me is that how many people show up from around the country anytime an officer loses their life serving, and they don't know the person, they'll show up just to be there. Why?
There's a quote on the southwest corner of the memorial. It says, "Carved on these walls is the story of America, of a continuing quest to preserve both democracy and decency and to protect a national treasure that we call the American dream." And I think when an officer dies in the line of duty, the broad American public responds to those very words and the very calling of the men and women who have sacrificed everything for them.
Think about the marshals in North Carolina that lost their lives. And I'm also thinking about Jonathan Diller, who is in my town. And I watched that town being totally taken over like I've never seen before. And there are people miles on the road, five or six deep, that would stand for hours as they waited for the hearse to show up and the mass to start.
You know, we're so lucky to live in this great country. And the fact is that oftentimes you won't find it on Twitter. You almost certainly won't find it on MSNBC. And to a worrying degree from even too many of our elected officials. But the reality is that there is a tsunami of support for law enforcement across this country. And every single officer, every single time an officer dies like that, the country comes out to help support the men and women who have died in the line of duty.
It was great the president went to Syracuse when those officers lost their lives. It was also very special for a former president to show up in Massapequa for Jonathan Dillard.
You know, I think it's appropriate and perfectly in tune with the responsibilities of the President of the United States to show up, to pay tribute to help all of us honor the men and women who have died for us.
How important is it for the politicians to the survival of the men and women who serve? How important is the rules they make and what they do?
It's so critically important. I have said for many years now that I think the existential crisis facing law enforcement is recruitment and retention. And the words from our elected leaders have and are having an impact, a negative impact on the ability of departments to recruit and retain, to interest the next generation in serving their country, serving their community. And there's just no question in my mind that anyone could steel man to me an argument that the words coming from too many of our politicians are having a detrimental impact and effect on the men and women who are trying to do this job.
What about the DAs when you make the arrest and put your lives on the line and then they don't get charged or they get out or the no cash bail?
Certainly another consideration. Men and women out there trying to do the job to some degree become demoralized when they feel like they're doing their part and the rest of the system is not keeping up with them. So, you know, there's lots of factors there. We try not to get too political, but the reality is that all of this combines to form a negative atmosphere towards and about law enforcement. And I think the tone and tenor of the conversation must change from our elected leaders.
And when you're doing your job, you can't worry about being put in jail yourself and your whole livelihood taken to its knees. You lose your job, you could lose your family, then you could lose your freedom. It hasn't been like that in the past.
It has not been like that in the past. And I know for certain that that has become a very strong consideration for the men and women out there on the street who are forced to make split-second decisions to save their own life or someone else's. It absolutely has become part of the decision-making process of an officer. And for certain, men and women now and in the future will be added to our very sacred walls by virtue of them hesitating, pausing even for a moment.
Right. What's going to be happening here tonight for people watching around the country? This candlelight vigil, 35 previous times you've done it. This is the 36th. Give me an idea what's going to take place.
It's so hard to put into words, but you will be able to feel the emotion coursing through the air here, coursing through the survivors, the co-workers, the peers of this profession, the men and women from our country, and even citizens from around the world come here to support law enforcement and to help celebrate the lives of the men and women who have died in the line of duty, to honor them, to help the survivors hopefully find peace as they make their way along the journey of healing, of which tonight is an integral, critical part.
And lastly, I do see some signs of hope. I'm not in law enforcement, but I hear recruitment is beginning to go up. The whole reimagined police, let's defund the police. Not many people are saying that anymore.
Certainly not politicians. I think that slogan and that idea has fallen on deaf ears, and that across the country, the men and women, the citizens who support and elect those elected leaders, right, are saying quite loudly, quite forcefully, that we support law enforcement, we need law enforcement.
Are more people coming to the academy?
You know, I left 2 years ago, and our numbers were down dramatically from the department I served in. We were down more than 400 officers, and that is the same as every department that I am aware of. Every department I know of is down in terms of the active slots they could fill and the active number of officers on the streets. I haven't seen evidence of it improving, but I hear you saying it, and I hope it's true.
What would improve it? Give me some ideas.
Men and women who are in positions of power, particularly elected positions, to come out forcefully and say, law enforcement has been and continues to be an overwhelming force for good, and we're so proud and lucky right. to have the men and women who are willing and able to go out and help protect our communities.
I know she didn't say money, right?
Men and women in uniform are not doing this job for money. They're doing it because it's a calling. It's because it's what they feel they must contribute back into the society which has given them so much. It's because they, like I hope every citizen hearing this today, is so incredibly lucky to call this country home.
And lastly, about the families. So it's that the officer serves, but the family's also serving.
The families are every bit as much as part of serving as the law enforcement officer, and they're every bit the victim when that officer dies in the line of duty. Find your local police officer, thank him or her. Say to him or her, you might not see support on Twitter, you might not see it on MSNBC, but I support you. We as a country need you.
We'll watch Fox.
Fox and friends, thank you so much for helping us to tell this story.
That's Bill Alexander, real impressive guy, and he's a guy who very much deserves to be in charge of that very important National Police Memorial Fund. Meanwhile, coming up next, actor, comedian, outspoken activist for Israel, John Lovitz. Don't move.
You're with Brian Kilmeade. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
So John Lovitz made his name really on SNL, but he spent his whole life acting and as a comedian. He owns his own comedy club for a while. He spoke up for the first time when Barack Obama was president. When he tried to vilify those so-called top 10%. He thought he was paying plenty of taxes. And he spoke up again when very few people in Hollywood or in entertainment was speaking up for Israel. So I talked to John Lovitz about why he's speaking up and why it's important to back Israel as an American, let alone a Jewish American.
One of the few celebrities to speak out about the rampant anti-Israeli college campus chaos is John Lovitz, the actor, comedian, calling out students blocking Jewish kids from getting to class, posting in part, you're supposed to be smart, you're blaming your 18-year-old classmates from the U.S. for the actions of the government of Israel. What the hell are you being taught? Think logically and quit being sheep and being used by your professors. Joining us now to describe this and expound on that is John Lovitz himself. John, it's not going away either, because now we see UC Irvine with a problem this week, DePaul, the NYU graduation. How do you explain it?
Well, it's the 250 chapters of Students for Justice for Palestine. It's like a fraternity on all the campuses, and then they're funded by American Muslims for Palestine, and which also funds Hamas. It's sad to me because I went to UC Irvine. That's where I went to college. And to think of being in college and I'm a drama major, I didn't know anything. And to be 18 and then being prevented from going to class. A neighbor of mine who is Jewish, she went to UCLA to like counter protest the students. And they were yelling, she said they're yelling at the counter protesters, you know, turn the Jews into soap and go back to Poland, and Hitler didn't finish. And, you know, you see a video of a guy, a radical jihadist saying, you know, we want to infiltrate the education system and get people elected in government. And he goes, we've already succeeded in Dearborn, Michigan, which is Rashida Tlaib, and Tlaib, or however you say
who
your
cares?
Name.
Yeah,
and,
I get it.
And they're doing it, you know, and Elie Wiesel wrote a book about the Holocaust called Night. And he said, you know, this village idiot disappeared for 4 days and showed up and said, they're killing all the Jews. They're putting them on trains and this. And I feel like I'm the village idiot. I talked to other Jewish people. They don't believe it. I mean, they're like they're ostriches. It's like it's happening again. And you've got to. I appreciate you inviting me to come on your show and speak out, because you've got to nip it in the bud.
Absolutely.
And I'm honored to be on the same show as your other guests, Noah Tishby and Emmanuel Acha. Their book, it's so important. And I learned a lot about it from Noah Tishby, you know.
Absolutely. They got a democracy in the Middle East, the longest-running, most loyal ally, and suddenly Americans can't get behind him. It makes no sense. And, John, I think people should know about you. You said you grew up a Democrat who loved Kennedy. They believe in hard work, you know, and you feel as though in many ways there's so many Democrats now who have trouble deciding who the good guys are, especially Bernie Sanders.
Well, he's, you know, he goes, I'm a democratic socialist. And well, that's just a communist that you can vote for. That's the only difference. And they go, well, we'll tax you to death, and then we'll pay for your college, we'll pay for this, we'll pay for that. But they're not paying for it. They're paying it with your money.
Idiots.
You know, and I'm not Republican either. I'm not right wing. I don't know what. I feel like I'm in the middle, and everything moves so far left and right. But for some reason, all the Republicans and Fox News, they're supporting Israel. And it's shocking to me because, you know, my life is Democrat and liberal, and it was liberal to support Israel. It was liberal to have more freedom of choice, and the parties seem to have switched.
I hear you.
Completely.
So, John, I also know you spoke out, too, because you own a comedy club, and you talk about being ridiculed for not paying taxes because you were successful. I remember that's the first time I heard you speaking out. I heard how angry you were back then. But I think people should know how talented you are and what you've achieved. I want to take a little look back at your career for everyone at home. Watch.
Okay.
Did you burn yourself?
Yeah.
Oh, I told you.
Oh, God.
No, sorry. My husband, he burned his finger, ma'am. Yeah, he was cooling and then he was waiting.
Help. Not helping.
Not
helping. I really like your dike. Bike.
I played third base, and I was so busy I didn't have time to eat. My eyes started going bad. Yeah. In fact, I was totally blind playing third base and catcher for the Kansas City Royals in the World Series.
Been a thin slice of heaven.
Bye.
Wait, you're going?
Dry your eyes. Yeah, I'm just going home, grab a shower and a shave, give the wife a little pickle tickle, and I'm on my way. I'll see you.
Yeah, but...
But what? Field, tryouts, play.
Joe, what are your thoughts watching that?
I can't believe I had a career. Where did it go?
You have a great career. There's an actor, comedian, you do it all.
I'm singing too. I do a singing show and comedy show. I'm doing that.
Oh, that's awesome.
Stand up. It's fun.
But
that's America. You know, you have the opportunity to make something of yourself if you're willing to work hard and stick to it, you know. And the tax thing, I was upset because they were saying the upper, whatever, income makers weren't paying their fair share. And I'm like, it's over 50%. It's like, that's just not true, you know.
And that's still the case. In fact, the thing has gotten worse. And finally, why aren't there more Jewish people in Hollywood speaking out? How does that make any sense?
I don't know. I mean, the ones I see on Twitter speaking out all the time are the actor Michael Rapaport, who's I worked with him in a Woody Allen film. Michael's a great guy. And from Everybody Loves Raymond, Patricia Heaton, and, you know, played Ray Romano's wife. And she's not Jewish. She speaks out constantly. I mean, the support from her and people that aren't Jewish is great.
John, I appreciate you speaking out. And I know you and Jerry Seinfeld and others are getting a lot of people's respect for that. Thanks so much, John. Appreciate
it. You've got it. Everyone needs to speak out, not just me, everybody.
I know. Hopefully, you're leading the charge. Thank you, John. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Always love talking to John Lovitz. I don't know if you realize it, but the first time I met him, I was playing in a Chris Everett tournament, fundraising tournament. He was a tennis player. I was barely getting by. I actually teamed with Chris Everett and Martina Navratilova. Steve Ducey was on the other side. And John Lovitz was in the tournament. It was hysterical. Coming up next, Callie Means, co-author of Good Energy, the number one book on Amazon right now. You'll find out why you need to find out what you're eating and why you might be getting fat. It might not be your fault. Callie Means next.
If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome back. Brian Kilmeade Show. We're going to take a step away from politics for a second and welcome in Callie Means, co-founder of TrueMed Payments and co-author of the brand new book, Good Energy, The Surprising Connection Between Metabolism and Limitless Health. And Callie, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian.
First off, what prompted you to look into health and the food industry and how they're related to and how they might be in bed together?
Yeah. So my co-author is my sister, and my sister at Stanford Med School did not take one course on nutrition. She figured out that actually 80% of the entire course was on pharmacology, and the majority of Stanford Med School, Harvard Med School's budget comes from pharma. I used to work for the food and pharma industry and actually saw these decisions up close. And what we've put together is a very simple economic fact. It's not conspiratorial. It's a simple statement of economic fact, is that the largest industry in the country, the healthcare industry, they make money when your kid is sick, depressed, infertile. They make money by treating those conditions and managing those conditions, and they lose money when we learn metabolic habits, when we learn the basics and get out of that chronic disease treadmill.
So instead of you're saying medicine solving those problems, they're creating those problems to solve and make money.
9 out of 10 deaths, leading causes of death in America are preventable lifestyle conditions. 95% of all medical spending is on completely preventable chronic conditions. If you have an acute issue, if you have a gunshot wound, burst appendix, complicated childbirth, infection, go to the doctor. Absolutely. That's 5% of medical spending. chronic disease is the greatest profit generating mechanism in modern history. And this amoeba of the healthcare system, again, our largest industry and fastest growing, is predicated on us getting more chronic diseases. That's just a simple economic fact.
So you mean major food companies, the Procter & Gamble, the General Mills, they're in bed meeting with the medical associations in order to do this?
They actually literally are. So working for the food companies as a lobbyist and the pharma industry, I actually brokered payments between Coke and the American Diabetes Association. The American Diabetes Association, which sets the standard of care for diabetes management in this country, which is a scourge and really underpinning all other chronic conditions, accepts millions of dollars from diabetes water, from Coca-Cola. They should be shouting from the rooftop about the fact that kids are ingesting 100 times more sugar than they did 100 years ago. The reason we're getting sicker, more depressed, more infertile isn't complicated. It's because of our broken food system. This is unique in America. In Japan, the childhood obesity rate is 3%. Here, it's upwards of 25%.
And it's not so. You don't think it's because more our kids are less active?
Absolutely. A sedentary lifestyle, which we incentivize too, is a huge problem. The book is about the underpinnings of metabolic health, which is simple. It's our diet, it's environmental toxins, it's sleep, it's exercise, it's the basics. But working for the food companies, I also help steer money to exercise groups to distract the issue. Michelle Obama talked about food in the first year when she was on this campaign in the White House, which was right, but she actually got paid off by the food industry to start talking about exercise. We should not be distracted. Our food system is compromised, and not only is our medical system silent on the reason we're getting sick, and they're overcomplicating the reason we're getting sick. And if you have diabetes, heart disease, depression, other comorbidities, you're going to see multiple doctors for multiple treatment plans on those. This is what the book's about. This is the most important issue in our country, which I think does tie to politics, because we're going to lose our human capital and we're going to go bankrupt from this. Chronic diseases are interrelated, and that simplicity is ignored by our medical system because it's profitable to keep people sick and manage the condition.
And would you say also it's cheaper to get the food that's bad for you when you got to go out of your way and pay more for the food that's good for you?
Let's break this down. On the food side, it makes sense. It's in their interest to keep food cheap and keep it addictive. There's been a complete crony capitalist takeover of our regulatory agencies. The USDA that makes our nutrition guidelines for kids, 95% of the USDA panel was paid off for by food companies, which is just hard to even
fathom. What do you mean by paid off? Like
the direct contributions, not research grants, but actually direct consulting payments. 95% of the USDA panel received direct consulting payments from processed food companies and or pharmaceutical companies.
Well, wouldn't you want the USDA to be, if you're creating a food that you want mass produced, wouldn't you want the USDA to support it? So wouldn't you go out of your way to have them approve it? Hey, I'm working on this. I'm working on that.
USDA, this is not political. This is not even getting into policy. The USDA that makes the guidelines for food that go to our kids should be following the science, should be uncorrupted. They should not be taking money from Coca-Cola. They should not be taking money from Kraft, okay? They have taken that money. They're directly paid off. I helped do it. And the guidelines we exist under today say that a two-year-old should have 10% of their diet as added sugar, a two-year-old. When we have a metabolic health crisis among children, and 33% of young adults have pre-diabetes right now, 50% of young adults are overweight or obese. And we have the panel that is making our medical guidelines saying that two-year-olds should be eating sugar, added sugar. It's unconscionable.
So let me ask you, when did this relationship first start?
But the devil's bargain between food and pharma? It started actually in 1960 with the invention of the birth control pill. The birth control pill was the first drug in American history that you didn't stop taking after you were cured of the condition. And there's documentation of this. The pharmaceutical industry taking a lot of trust of science with antibiotics and some medical innovations helping to win World War II. They said, we can take that trust. And this is documented. And they said, we're going to now invent chronic conditions. What a gold mine. You can take a pill for your entire life. You don't get cured. And now what do we have? We have statins, one of the most prescribed drugs in the country. The more statins are prescribed, the more heart disease goes up. The more metformin is prescribed, 100 million plus prescriptions of that, the more diabetes goes up. The more antidepressants are prescribed. 25% of women in the United States are on an antidepressant. The more suicide and depressions goes up. There has never been a chronic disease pharmaceutical treatment that has lower rates of the chronic disease it's trying to treat. And this is amazing because people just keep racking on the comorbidities and racking on the interventions.
So Callie Means, our guest, Good Energy, the book, The Surprising Connection Between Metabolism and Limitless Health. So, Callie, you realize how many people would have to have this evil intention for this to come off? I mean, think about how what doctor would go to sleep at night saying, oh, okay, I just got a drug. I'm going to get a percentage of money from a drug because someone's has a chronic disease, which I help create.
This is not about intentions. To understand a system, don't look at what people say. Don't even look at what individuals think. Look at what the system does. It is a completely unemotional statement of economic fact that the healthcare industry growth is predicated on more kids getting sicker earlier and staying sick. The industry just fundamentally makes money from managing interventions on people that are sick. And when you have the largest interest in the country that's fundamentally incentivized for more Americans to get sick, that's what happens. The brilliance, and this is what we unpack in the book and what has really taken me a long time to understand, the genius of the institutional design of our healthcare system is that it takes good people. It takes my sister, who got into this for the right reasons. All doctors do. They can make money in easier ways. It saddles them with debt. And now the highest suicide rate and the highest burnout rate of any profession is among doctors. They understand they are trapped in a sick system. I absolutely believe that cardiologists want to cure and snap their fingers and cure the world of heart disease, that hormone doctors want to cure the world of diabetes, that obesity doctors now want to cure the world of obesity. But their job and their employment is predicated on more people getting sick. That is just a fact.
What do you think about Ozempic?
So Ozempic is a great example.
And all the other drugs like that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think it's really important to go into specifics. Ozempic, I believe, is one of the biggest issues in the country, and here's why. The American Academy of Pediatrics, which is a fully funded subsidiary of pharma but sets the standard of care for pediatric care, recently said that this should be the first-line defense for any obese or overweight 12-year-old. That's 50% of 12-year-olds. I have a message to every parent listening. If your child is the median 12-year-old who's overweight or obese, they are going to be pushed Ozempic, which is a lifetime drug with just demonstrably the highest side effect of any wide-scale drug approved in modern American history. 50% of people go off because of severe vomiting or nausea, which clearly means there's other things going on.
So 50% of people who get on Ozempic get off because you feel so terrible.
It's the worst and most pronounced side effects of a drug in modern American history that's been widely prescribed. Yes, it is causing unknown gastrointestinal issues that are leading to severe nausea and vomiting. It has a black box warning for cancer. There's an EU investigation into suicidal ideation.
What's a black box warning mean?
Black box warning means the most serious warning the FDA can give on thyroid cancer because it causes such hormone disruption. It is there's large-scale investigations in the EU, its home area. This is a company from Denmark, on suicidal ideation, which makes sense, Brian. Our medical system doesn't realize the interconnectivity. But 95% of our serotonin, which regulates our contentment and mood, is produced in the gut, not the brain. And Ozempic is gut dysfunction. That's what it causes. That's the effect of drugs. There's serious side effects. This is being rushed because it's a lifetime drug, and it's being pushed now on 12-year-olds. The key question with Ozempic is if we have an obesity crisis where 80% of American adults and 50% of young adults are overweight or obese, is this because of an Ozempic deficiency? Or is this because we're uniquely poisoning our population in America? This should not be the standard of care.
So Callie Means was helping us out there. Casey is the doctor and the sister of Callie. Such an impressive book. So many questions need to be answered. He's so bold and smart. And they both, by the way, look extremely healthy. When we come back, let's talk with Callie about the side effects and dangers of Ozempic. Listen up, everybody. You'll need to hear it. You're listening to The Brian Kilmeade Show.
This is the Brian Kilmeade Show. Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Welcome back, everybody. It's time for part two of a book you need to hear about that you probably heard some buzz about. And the name of the book is Good Energy. Callie Means is my guest. And I spoke to Callie late last week because they were in town about him and his sister, how this whole book came to be. Now, his sister going through medical school realized there was something seriously wrong about the medical profession. So she tried to change it. They've created a brand new company. But here we talk about the rage in this country, and that's Ozempic. It's the end of obesity, they claim. But is there a downside? They say absolutely. Here is more of my interview with Callie Means on The Brian Kilmeade Show.
You also write that muscle depletion is real
And the only way to avoid the muscle depletion is have a high-protein diet, low-fat, which, by the way, if you have that, you're going to lose weight anyway.
This is a game, you know, and I know you had some other guests on who are writing books. We don't need a book on this.
We don't need a long
diatribe on this to make money from the Ozempic craze. We need to speak in very plain facts. Any doctor, actually, if they're pushed, will tell you, and they actually say this, and they guide this, you are going to have severe muscle loss issues if you don't work out 5 times a week with strength training and shift your diet to a low ultra processed food, high protein diet. My point, what we're doing with this book, which is resonating, it's now the number one book on Amazon, which we're really excited about. And this message of empowerment really is resonating. What I'm doing with my company, TrueMed, which actually incentivizes with medical dollars, food and exercise, doctors could be writing a letter of medical necessity, actually guiding the patients to keto diets, to exercise. We can actually be shifting the $4.5 trillion when somebody's pre-diabetic or obese to those things. The American people don't want to be fat, sick, depressed, infertile, which is also happening to an astounding degree. They don't want this. My mom didn't want to get cancer and die and not meet
her
grandkids.
Was she not eating well?
My mom was on the standard American food pyramid diet. She was the standard American patient. For 40 years, there were warning signs. Slightly high cholesterol, that's normal. Take the statin. Pre-diabetes, like 60% of people her age. Oh, that's normal. Take the metformin. Slightly high blood pressure. Oh, that's normal. Take the ACE inhibitor. She had these checks that the average American goes on throughout their life where it's, oh, no, it's no problem. That's normal. That's average for people your age. Take the pill. If once her doctor sat her down and explained that pancreatic cancer, which she eventually got, is as highly tied to prediabetes and blood sugar dysregulation as smoking is to lung cancer. Cancer is not a random occurrence. It's highly tied to our diet. It's highly tied to metabolic health. If she was explained and incentivized and educated on really reversing these conditions with basic metabolic habits, she'd still be here. But she, just months before cancer diagnosis, was told by our primary care provider that she was healthy for her age. On 5 medications, she was actually on less amount of medications than the average 70-year-old. She was actually a healthy patient. Life expectancy right now, Brian, is declining for the most sustained period since 1860. This year in 2024, we have the highest rates of cancer, highest rates of diabetes, highest rates of heart disease, highest rates of autism, autoimmune conditions. Go down the list of any condition ever in American history. Every single chronic condition is at an all-time high this year. Something is going very wrong. And the problem with Ozempic, again, this is very simple. Are we going to look at this devastation happening, particularly to kids? And are we going to drug kids for life with this poison, literal poison, that you have to stay on forever? Or are we going to finally ask, as America, and it's uniquely in America, they're not prescribing Ozempic as the standard of care in their home country, in Denmark. If you have prediabetes, you actually get a government-subsidized medical keto diet. They actually pay you to exercise. These are just rational policies that anyone could create to actually attack the root cause. But again, I cannot stress this enough. Every lever of the healthcare system is geared to making people sick. The other thing we talked about in the book, you just look at the money. Pharma pays 5 times more political donations than the oil industry. Pharma is, you know, funds a lot of the media. Pharma funds a lot of these interest groups like the NAACP, actually, that's calling anyone that criticizes Ozempic racist right now. The NAACP is a registered lobbyist for the maker of Ozempic to say it's a civil rights issue that we have to have government sponsored.
Why, is there a sense that there's obesity is large in the black community? Oh, how do they rationalize that?
Yeah, well, this is just the playbook. This is what I did. I helped Coke pay the NAACP 10 years ago to say that taking soda off of food stamps, it's the number one item on food stamps, that it was racist to deny choice to lower income people. This is the playbook, as we all know, and there's nobody better than the food and farm industries. You call people racist, you call people sexist, and these groups like the NAACP, unfortunately.
Have you felt backlash as you wrote your book? And now that it's out and doing well, good energy?
When my mom literally, as we buried her, the 13 days before her diagnosis and her death, was transformational for my sister and I. We really saw, and a lot of these pieces came together from our two careers, and we really feel like we're carrying on her memory and trying to prevent, again, the many, many people listening here who are probably on that chronic disease pharmaceutical treadmill. We can get off that path. There is a better way.
Where do you go? Do you provide that better way? What are some tips we can leave some people with to start getting control of their diet?
If you have an acute issue, if you have an infection or something that's going to kill you right away, listen to the medical system. If you have a chronic condition or your kid has a chronic condition, they're trying to put your kid on a statin, metformin, any of these drugs that are doubling rates of the prescriptions among teens in the past 5 years, Do not trust your doctor. It's just that simple. The doctor, any doctor, good doctor, should be writing a intervention for basic things, for exercise interventions, for sleep, which is down 25% in the past 100 years, and for food.
And where do you shop?
What's up?
Where should you shop?
You should be avoiding three ingredients: highly processed grains, sugar, and seed oils. You should be scouring your labels for that. In Japan and some European countries, the ultra-processed food consumption, things in a box, is 20-30%. Here it's 70%. If you can just simply cut those ingredients, which by definition cuts ultra-processed food, you are on a great path.
Food in a box. Avoid it.
100%.
Cereal.
I am engaged in a legal action against Kellogg. They actually reformulate their cereal with different ingredients for Americans because our regulations are so bought off. They contain artificial dyes, which they don't contain in any other country, which are one of the most known links to ADHD, these dyes that they include in their cereal. Absolutely avoid that. The grains in the United States are highly problematic. These ultra-processed frankenfoods that are sprayed with glyphosate and other chemicals that are banned in almost every other country. It's just weaponized fundamentally to make us want to eat more. And I'm really concerned about the chemicals on these foods, which are disrupting our gut bacteria and just causing this host of issues.
But all this stuff is in Good Energy, your brand new book.
We outline the problem, and through my sister's genius, who's a leading metabolic health doctor, we have an actionable plan. We've got to have a bottoms-up revolution.
Right.
Brian, I'm also engaged with a lot of great people and companies to lobby. We're working with across the aisle, frankly. You see President Trump talking about this, RFK talking about this. This issue of kids getting sick and then being drugged is I think, becoming one of the defining issues in our country.
All right. Name of the book is Good Energy, The Surprising Connection Between Metabolism and Limitless Health. Callie Means, congratulations on doing it, and to your sister.
Thank you, sir.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. In these ever-changing times, you can rely on Fox News for hourly updates for the very latest news and information on your time. Listen and download now at foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.